1984, the professional basketball team known as the Dallas Mavericks was in a critically important playoff game for those of us, especially who lived in Dallas during that time. Dallas was the underdog, and they were expected to lose to the Lakers, but they had fought hard all game, and it came down to the last 6 seconds. Dallas had possession. Derek Harper was the point guard, though, and for some strange reason, he thought his team was ahead by 1 point. And so when he got the inbound pass, he simply ran around and dribbled the ball and ran the time off. And when the buzzer sounded, he began to jump up and down celebrating their playoff victory. And he celebrated until his teammates came running up to him screaming that the game was tied. He had thrown away the last chance to make a final goal and win the game. They were forced into overtime and lost the game by 7 points. He was not well loved in Dallas for some time after that. Can you imagine this basketball player was celebrating an apparent victory and would have continued celebrating his happiness until someone finally came along and told him the truth, the reality of what was in fact the score of the game. For centuries, the Jewish nation has been celebrating their apparent victory over all other peoples, and they have been celebrating their position as sons of Abraham. They believed they had an edge over the rest of the world, and the Gentiles, they believed, were losing and they were winning. In Romans chapter 3, the Apostle Paul has just announced to them the shocking truth, and let's rejoin his announcement in verse 9. Romans chapter 3, verse 9, where we left off, where he delivers the astonishing news. What then? Are we better than they? That is, are the Jews really beating the Gentiles? Not at all. For we have already charged that both Jews and Greeks or Gentiles are all under sin. All are under sin. Now, if you take a closer look at this verse, which is what I want to do, you discover that Paul is making two rather sweeping, broad, categorical statements or declarations. First of all, Paul here in verse 9 is declaring the verdict of universal depravity. Look again. We have already charged. That's a legal term, by the way, that speaks of incriminating someone else by virtue of evidence. We have already incriminated both Jew and Greek that all are under sin. No one is exempt from the verdict. Nobody has an edge in this game. No Jew or Gentile has any reason to celebrate. The truth is, everyone is guilty of breaking the law, and everyone is therefore in deep trouble with a holy and righteous God. The world, of course, doesn't really appreciate this message. A number of years ago, a book was written entitled, I'm Okay, You're Okay. Probably heard about that. It's basically a book that taught the humanism of the day and still the humanism of today, that mankind certainly might have a few problems, but they're going to work through them because ultimately at the heart of man he is good and everybody is going to turn out all right because everybody is okay. And what most believers or unbelievers would appreciate us believers not doing is coming up to them and telling them, stop the party, stop the celebration. Stop jumping up and down for joy. There's nothing to celebrate about. In fact, you're in trouble with God, the holy judge. And that's exactly what Paul does here in verse 9 as he summarizes and he makes this sweeping declaration that all of humanity is guilty, as it were, of universal depravity. Nobody is okay. In fact, he'll add to this in verse 23. You ought to circle, by the way, the word all in verse 9 and draw a line to verse 23 and circle the word all there because it appears there. For all have sinned and all fall short of God's glory, God's perfect standard, God's holy being. What Paul will do in the next verses is he will simply lay out 14 indictments on the human race. If you feel like he has pounded upon humanity up to this point, just wait. There are 14 statements of indictments, really four expressions of mankind's depravity. In the first few verses, he describes the evil condition of mankind. Verse 10, he says, it's written, there's none righteous, not even one. There is none who understands. There is none who seeks for God. All have turned aside. Together they have become useless. All have done this. None are good. None are right with God. The next few verses describe the evil communication of mankind. Verse 13, their throat is an open grave. With their tongues they keep deceiving. The poison of asps is under their lips, whose mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. And then in the next few verses, he will simply express the evil chaos of mankind. Verse 15, their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their paths. And the path of peace have they not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes. Now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, that every mouth may be closed, and here's another all, and all the world may become accountable to God. Because by the works of the law, no flesh will be justified in his sight. No wonder the human race wants to get rid of the objective law of God. No wonder it wants to condemn as non-existent the objective standard of holiness they cannot keep, that condemns them and leaves them without excuse. Ken Hughes wrote in his book, a book entitled The Disciplines of a Godly Man, that only 13% of people in this country, only 13% of Americans believe that all 10 commandments are now binding. We've sort of been whittling away at the list, and now only a handful believe that all of them are binding on humanity today. No wonder God is dishonored and parents are dishonored and relationships are dishonored. He went on to reveal that this same survey posed the question to people at random. Perhaps you've heard of this. What are you willing to do for $10 million? And then they asked a series of questions. Would you be willing to do this for $10 million? 25% of the people who were promised anonymity, of course, said that for $10 million they would abandon their families entirely. 23% said they would become a prostitute for at least a week. 7% said that they would be willing to consider killing a stranger for $10 million. Imagine that in a crowded section of a mall containing 100 people, 7 of them would take your life if they could just get enough money for it. You say, oh, people wouldn't do that. Well, people are doing it for less, are they not? Are not people abandoning their families for much less than $10 million? Are they not abandoning their morals for far less than $10 million? The truth is, we're cheap. Cheap. The survey also found that 91% of the respondents lied regularly at home and at work. Lying, the author said, has become so much the American way that even in the highest places of leadership, honesty is becoming more and more the exception, and that's true. In the last 20 years, we have developed a cynicism, have we not? If somebody tells you something, we immediately think they're probably not telling the truth, no matter who they are. I pulled a quote some time ago from Fred Holloman. He's a rather outspoken chaplain of the Kansas Senate. He crafted an interesting prayer, which he prayed as the Senate opened session. He said this, he prayed this, "Omniscient Father, help us to know who is telling the truth today. One side tells us one thing, the other side tells us the opposite. And also, if neither side is telling the truth, we'd like you to tell us that too. And if each side is telling only half the truth, give us the wisdom to put the right halves together. In Jesus' name, amen." Isn't that a great way to open the Senate? Well, back in verse 9, Paul has declared that basically everyone is filled with lying, everyone is filled with deceit, everyone is filled with dishonesty, everyone is filled with immorality, everyone is guilty of universal depravity. Depravity, by the way, is a word that simply means wretchedness. You could use other synonyms like ruined, sinful. We use the word depraved, degenerate. Webster correctly defines it as wicked perversion. I've met a lot of people in my life who've been willing to admit they're not perfect. Everybody's willing to admit they're not perfect, but few would be willing to admit that they're wickedly perverse. And they certainly wouldn't appreciate you going up to them and even suggesting that they might be wicked and perverse. No one is exempt. No one has reason to celebrate. Everyone is in deep trouble with God, and that is one side of the gospel. And that is the verdict that Paul has just delivered. The declaration from Paul in verse 9 is not only the verdict of universal guilt, but secondly, the evidence of universal dominion. Paul wrote, "For all are under," what's the next word? Sin. For all are under sin. Now, there's a word that's disappearing from the English vocabulary, is it not? The little three-letter word, sin. Say it with me. Sin. Say it again. Sin. See, even to say it imitates the sound of a serpent, doesn't it? Sin. We don't like that word. For one thing, the word doesn't leave us any loophole. There's no way around it. There's no way out of it. In fact, it relates us to the activity of the serpent. We'll do anything but admit, I have sinned. Donald Gray Barnhouse wrote in his 1953 commentary on this text. I've enjoyed reading him as he describes some of these scenes with vivid illustrations. He described the man here who has a hard time saying he's sinned or coming under the condemnation of depravity. He says, that man is like a little boy. That man stands before God like a little boy, stands in front of his mother and swears with crying and tears that he has not been anywhere near the jam jar, and who, with an air of outraged innocence, pleads the justice of his position in total ignorance of the fact that a good spoonful of the jam has fallen on his shirt just under his chin and is plainly visible to everybody but himself. I haven't had any jam. He doesn't see it. It's right there. I haven't sinned. I'm not a sinner. I mean, I'm not perfect, but I'm not a sinner. That's why Paul, as he drives this summary home, will give the evidence in these 14 indictments of sin. I want you to know that this is the first time in the book of Romans that the word sin has appeared. Now, you would probably think, as I had, that we've talked a lot about sin, haven't we? Well, in the first two chapters, Paul certainly has discussed sin. He's graphically described even sinful behavior and sinful thinking. But now, however, for the first time, the word itself appears. It's the Greek word hamartion. It simply translates to miss the mark. To miss the mark. The mark, or the target, is God's holy standard. And he, in effect, declares that everyone on planet Earth is a terrible shot. We've all missed it. We've missed the mark somewhere. But the world insists that it hasn't. In fact, it wants to move the target to wherever it has displaced its arrow. It wouldn't admit that it's sinned. The world admits to mistakes. You know, we've made some mistakes. We've committed some errors in judgment. We've made some wrong miscalculations, some boo-boo, you know, some blunder, but not sin. What are you, Victorian or something? You from the Dark Ages? So guilty mankind, in his supposed sophistication, simply replaces that little three-letter word with a variety of more comfortable words. John MacArthur published a book entitled The Vanishing Conscience, in which he just explains this entire issue in that volume. He talks about how sin and guilt have become public enemy number one. Let's get rid of sin. Let's get rid of any talk of sin. Let's get rid of any guilt or talk of guilt, and we'll feel better. Well, do we feel better? No, we don't feel better. But he goes on to say these days in his volume, everything wrong with humanity is likely to be explained as an illness, an addiction, a result of some pre-existing disability. What we used to call sin is more easily diagnosed now as a whole array of disabilities. All kinds of immorality and evil conduct are now identified as symptoms of some disorder. Modern culture has created thus a new gospel. Man is not a sinner, but a victim. A couple of illustrations that I have filed away that reveal this kind of thinking that has now swept our culture away. One man who was shot, paralyzed while committing a burglary in New York, sued the store owner who shot him. They went to trial. His attorney told the jury that the man was first of all a victim of society, driven to steal by his economic disadvantages. Then the lawyer said his client was a victim of the insensitivity of the store owner who shot him, who had no regard for his plight as a victim. And now he would be confined to a wheelchair for the rest of his life. He deserves some redress. And the jury agreed. And the store owner had to pay the thief a settlement. An FBI agent was fired some time ago after he embezzled $2,000 from the bureau and then gambled it away in one afternoon in a casino. Later, he sued, arguing that his gambling was an addiction, thus a disability, and being fired was thus an act of discrimination. And he won the case and was rehired. One man wrote that this victimism has so infected our culture that one might even say the victim has become the mascot of modern society. Ladies and gentlemen, Paul does not refer anywhere to victims. He doesn't even refer to addictions, by the way. He refers to sinners. And he calls it what? He calls it sin. He says, all are under sin. What does it mean when he says all are under sin? Well, the word translated under is the original word hupo. It means, it's an interesting word that means under the power of, under the dominating influence of, under the authority of. In fact, it's used in Matthew chapter 9, verse 6 of the centurion. He uses it when he tells Jesus, I have soldiers under me, hupo. In other words, I have soldiers under my command. They are under my authority. They do my bidding. They are dominated by me by rank. It was also used in Greek writings of a student who was under the tutelage of his teacher, his professor. That is, he was under the direction. He was under the leading, the authority of his professor. So here, Paul says, in effect, all of mankind is under the authority, is under the tutelage, is under the direction, is under the command, is under the leading, is under the dominating force of sin. You see how foolish it is for a person to say, well, I'm going to do some good things over here and that'll compensate. No. We are under sin. John wrote in 1 John 5:19 that the whole of humanity lies under the power of the evil one. Jesus himself had, while on earth, announced the same truth in his message to Jewish leaders. Turn back to the gospel by John for a minute and look at chapter 8. John chapter 8, where he says exactly the same thing that Paul says, only uses different words. John chapter 8, look at verse 34. Jesus answered them, truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who commits sin, and how many people commit sin? Tell me. All. So all who commit sin are the what? Slaves of sin. Enslaved to sin. He says here, this is the absolute truth. In fact, whenever Jesus Christ says truly, truly, it's not that he just likes the word and he wants to repeat it. He's in effect saying, take note now, truly, of a truth, I tell you this. This is something that I want you to mark in your minds. You are not free. You are enslaved, as it were, to sin. And you reveal that by what? By sinning. And then he speaks specifically to the people in his audience, which were the Jewish leaders. And he says in verse 35 something that's a little difficult to understand, and I'll explain it. He says, and the slave does not remain in the house forever. The son does remain forever. If, therefore, the son makes you free, you shall be free indeed. You're enslaved to sin, but the son will set you free. What's this about being in the house? Where'd that come in? Well, let me illustrate his illustration. Basically, what he's saying is that the Jews believe they own the house. By virtue of their relationship to Abraham, being of his seed, they believe that they own the Father's house. And Christ here informs them they're just servants. Well, let me illustrate what he's saying with an illustration of my own. When I was in Dallas with my wife in our last year of seminary training, Marcia delivered our twin boys into the world. And we thought we wouldn't have kids until after school, and God had other plans, so we had them in the last year, which is really interesting. As a result of that, in fact, several months before that, she had to go to bed because of a difficult pregnancy. And so I had taken a part-time job to put a little food on the table and make ends meet until graduation, and then we'd be out on our own in ministry somewhere. And I was able to land a job with a very prosperous commercial real estate firm in North Dallas as a courier. What I did was basically run errands for these men. There were about 11 of them. These men were making $200,000, $300,000, $500,000 in one commission check. And this was in the 80s, mid-80s, when everything was incredibly rosy, and then it went bust. And They all pretty much lost their shirts. But I ran errands. I would run contracts between them and other buyers, bankers, attorneys, and such. And so I'd go after classes and just spend my time in the afternoon on the road. Well, one day I came to work and after class, and the president of the company pulled me aside and he handed me the keys to his car. And he said, "Stephen, I want you to take my car over to the dealership and have the tires rotated and wait there while they're doing it, okay?" I said, "Sure." And I thought, well, it's going to be a good afternoon. I'm not going to be on the road. But then it hit me. Wait a second. I'm going to take his car. I'd seen his car. It was a limited edition Mercedes sports coupe. Not nearly as nice as a Chevy pickup. But anyhow, this is what he drove. It was a hardtop convertible. It was white. I remember it had a deep blue roof. It was virtually brand new. I had seen a description of the car in the office as all the guys were hovering around it and knew that it cost nearly $150,000. So I very gingerly slipped into the driver's seat and I prayed, "Lord, I'm in seminary. I can't afford diapers, much less a dent, a ding, a scrape, even swift air. You know, please do a Red Sea moment and part the traffic as I drive North Dallas, you know, to this dealership, which is about 5 miles away." And so I eased out of the parking lot and onto the parkway and began this 5 mile trip. It wasn't long before I noticed something. I noticed that people were looking at me as they drove by. I remember pulling up to the first red light, and people on both sides of me looked at me. It was a different kind of look than I'd ever had. It was envy. They looked at that car, and they looked at me, and I could tell, oh man, was I making people guilty of deep sin and coveting that day. I never had that look when I drove down the parkway in my green Velari. No one ever looked at me in any way other than sympathy. But here I am, and I'm pulling up at this red light. People on both sides are looking at me, and I know they're thinking, this guy has made it to the top. He is somebody. You know what I did? I nodded back. Fix the rear view mirror, you know, pick up the car phone, yeah. I was going to get everything out of this now, man. This was great. He had told me on my way there or on my way back, whichever, to get some gas to fill it up. And I had been worried about that. But now, man, I was looking for the busiest gas station I could find. I'd pull in there, and I did. People everywhere. I got out, and the guy next to me immediately said, "Man, that is a beautiful car." I said, "Thanks." He said, "How long have you had it?" Now what do? You know, temptation. I did the right thing. I said, "I've had it about 10 minutes. It's not mine. It's my boss's car." And he goes, "Oh." I wanted to let the air out of his tires when he went to pay for his gas. But in 5 seconds, they went from being somebody to nobody. And I got to admit, though, it was fun acting for a few minutes like that car belonged to me. I didn't own one shiny inch of that car. I was a servant. I was a hired hand. None of it belonged to me. This is what he's saying. The Jewish leaders, in effect, had this smirk on their faces, this sense of confidence. We own the house. And Jesus says, "No, you're just the hired servant. The only people that get to stay in the house are those who are sons. But you're slaves to sin. You're slaves to sin. And slaves don't stay in the house." See, Paul will amplify that in chapter 3 of Romans, and he will say it's not just the Jew, it's the Gentile. Everyone is under sin, enslaved to sin, which means we'll never own one inch of the Father's house. We're not getting in. We're headed in the wrong direction. We have nothing for which to celebrate. We haven't won anything. In fact, unless something dramatic happens when the final score is tallied, we're going to lose the game. All of humanity is sinful and guilty and under this irresistible pull, this undertow, this domination of sin. What's the evidence, Paul, for you to make that kind of sweeping statement that covers everyone on planet Earth who's ever lived, who lives, and who will ever live in the future? He will give it in those 14 indictments. And he will deliver them to the human race as he describes the depravity of man, the evil condition of man, the evil communication of man, the evil chaos of man, and ultimately the other side of the gospel, which is the deliverance of God through Christ. Jesus Christ came into the world to save those kind of people, right? He didn't come into the world to save victims. He didn't come into the world to save those with addictions. He came into the world to save sinners. He came to save sinners. And he saves them even today.